All righty. Now, we have been in the book of Daniel, and it is a great book of prophecy. And Daniel prayed in the ninth chapter in earnest for his people because he wanted to know. He had been in captivity for like 69 years, and he wanted to know, Lord, when is it going to be done? And God showed him 70 years. And in his excitement, his thought was, wow, this is the end of it. We're all done. And then God gave him a greater vision in Daniel chapter 9, verse 24, 25, 26, 27. And in those four little verses, explained to Daniel, well, it's going to take me longer than just 70 years to finish everything I need to do with your people. It's going to take me 70 weeks of years, which is 490 years. And so Daniel gets this long revelation here. And of course, it troubled him a little bit. And in the 10th chapter, the angel Gabriel visited him, because I imagine Daniel continued his prayers like he always does. And his prayers were heavy-hearted because he realized the sin of my people is going to take much longer than I thought. By the way, sin does take longer in our lives, and it binds us up and keeps us longer. It'll keep you longer than when you want to stay. It'll make you more than you want to pay. It's just sin is difficult, and God's in the business of cleaning up sin. So Gabriel came to him and said, let me explain in the last verse, chapter 10, 21, I will show thee that which is noted in the scripture of truth. And God has sent me with a message to show you a little bit more, because now that you know there's 490 years left in this whole deal, I want to show you some of the things that are going to happen during those 490 years. And what we learn as we began to study it last week is that when God gives a prophecy, it's pre-written history. And we began to study how, you know, there's going to be this many Persian kings, and then after that there's going to be a king named Alexander the Great in the third verse, and then his kingdom, when he dies, will be broken up, and he doesn't have any kids, and it'll go to his four generals in verse 4, and then after that there's going to be these Syrian wars between Syria and Egypt, and there's going to be 106 years of wars with interrupted periods of peace, and the king of the north is the king from Syria, and the king of the south is the king from Egypt. And over the years, there will be slightly different kings. And God didn't give the names of these individuals, but he wrote it out in such a way that as the years were passing, you could see the prophecies here. And the last time we were studying together, we were around verse 13, when the king of the north, and by now we're looking at the king of the north in Syria is known as Antiochus the Great. Sometimes he's called Antiochus Magnus or Antiochus Magus. Magus Magnus means great. And the king of the north is going to return, and he's going to come back. He's going to build a great army of 62,000 footmen with 6,000 horses and 102 elephants, and he's going to come against the southern kingdom of Egypt. And he takes over that thing, and they fall. And now we're coming to verse 15, because we finished verse 14 last time, so you can go back and listen to the tapes from that. And now we're at the continuing on in the prophecy. And just to give you a background, what happened after he won that battle there in Egypt, he returned to his capital city, and he reveled in his latest victory. And what had happened in Egypt is when the king of Egypt had died, his young six-year-old child took the throne. And Antiochus Magnus in Syria was like, what am I worried about, a six-year-old? I don't need to go kill him. Let Egypt live with a six-year-old king. And he just stayed up in his area. And the new king, the six-year-old boy, ruled for 24 years to the age of 30. He didn't make it that far anyways. Now, for the very first decade, when this six-year-old boy was on the throne, he didn't know what he was doing. It's not uncommon when there's a young king that there are teachers and tutors and courtiers to work with him. And in the Egyptian court, there were two men, one by the name of Sosibius and another man by the name of Agathocles. And Sosibius more or less took care of the child's needs, but Agathocles was a bright administrator. And he's, you know, Egypt has just been lost to battle, and I need to rebuild our land. And thankfully, the guy from the north, Antiochus Magus, isn't bothering us. Let me rebuild the area here. And he quickly began to solidify and rebuild Egypt and put a new regime in place. He went out, and he hired some mercenaries. They're called chosen mercenaries. Let me see, verse 15. The king of the north shall come and cast them out and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people. So here's, let me just explain what happened. So in the meantime, Agathocles is building, he's hiring mercenaries, he's building fenced cities, and Antiochus Magus is just staying up there, up in Syria, minding his own business. For about 10 years, Agathocles is building, he starts building fenced cities in Egypt. Then he says, you know, we should move our cities up into Sinai, so if this guy ever comes back before he gets to Egypt, he's got to fight us here. He did that in the first 3 or 4 years. And they said, you know what? Let's move up a little bit more into where the Philistines are. And he built some fenced cities there. Let's even build some cities in Israel. And Israel was, they never really regathered their strength after the second temple was built. The people had lived in Babylon so long, they never became a religious worshiping people anymore. They were just kind of God on their lips, and they were living like the world. And so he built cities in Israel, and he fortified these cities with stockpiles of munitions. And it turned out that Israel now was ruling over Israel from their fortified fenced cities. What a sad irony. Remember, God had delivered them out of Egypt, and now Egypt is ruling over them, and Antiochus Magnus is just sitting in Syria. But word finally comes to him. Somebody brings a message. Do you know what that little six-year-old has done? He couldn't do much. No, but the guy leading him has built up a whole bunch of cities all the way through Sinai, Philistia, and Israel. And you better watch out. These guys are built up. So, verse 15, the king of the north decided to come again. And he cast a mount, and he put a siege to take those most fenced cities. And he had superior weapons, he had superior strength, superior manpower. Remember, Egypt was rebuilding, Syria was in a place of strength, their economy was strong, so he was able to come down, take the fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people. All the chosen mercenaries that Agathocles had hired for the Egyptians couldn't stand against the well, you know, trained forces of the Syrian king of the north. It says, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. They couldn't stand against him. And Antiochus Magus came down in 2001 BC with his armies. He attacked all the strongholds, and by 198, he had wiped them all out, and this ended all the Egyptian rule in Judea. And now the Egyptians aren't there anymore. That's good on one hand. On the other hand, the Syrians are going to take over. The problem is because the Jewish people, the Israelites, had wandered from God and had become worldly, that's a form of sin in God's eyes. And God isn't going to keep a hand of protection on them at that particular time. And so now, although the Egyptians aren't ruling, the king of the north is in there. Verse 16. He that cometh against him shall do according to his own will. None shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land. And here's Antiochus Magnus. He now has dominion over Israel. And it says at the end of the verse, which by his hand shall be consumed. And when he was there, he thought, what the heck? Let's take some spoils out of Israel. Let's waste whatever these people have. And he stole from the Jewish people. Verse 17. And then he also shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones will be with him, and thus shall he do. Now what happened is he had come down from Syria. He had wiped out the fenced cities of the Egyptians. He took control of himself. He took some booty back to Syria. And from that he said, you know, this is a good place to launch against Egypt. Because who does that little punk think he is doing this? And Magnus wants to go back, and I'm going to go back into Egypt, and I'm going to, verse 17, he'll set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and the upright ones are with him, thus shall he do. But he ran into a problem when he got there. As he started to approach Egypt, he found out that Egypt had a new ally, Rome. Because Egypt was supplying the city of Rome with grain. And the Romans now were going to support their trading partner because Rome is a city and they need food. Cities need farmers to bring them food. You can't do much farming in a city. And so now the Roman Empire, this is about 195 B.C., and you got to remember, we're going to go back to the prophecies Daniel was given. Daniel was told, he said, you know, after Babylon will be Medo-Persia. After Medo-Persia will be Greece and Alexander the Great. But Alexander the Great, when he dies, he doesn't have any children. His kingdom will be broken up into four kingdoms. And you've got the Syrians here and the Egyptians here. And you've got Lysimachus and Cassander, one in Asia and one in Macedonia. But around Israel, it's the Syrians and the Egyptians. But when a kingdom is divided, it doesn't have the strength it used to have. Divide and conquer is a good tactic. And so it's getting weaker. And so God told Daniel, he said, and after Greece will come Rome. And at the same time as Greece is breaking up and the kingdoms are fighting, Rome is consolidating and bringing their power together. And they have a republic, and they have a senate, and they don't have an emperor. They have good statesmen who are leading them, and they're building together, and they're making trading partners. And one of their trading partners now is Egypt. And so when Antiochus Magnus wants to come to Egypt, the Romans are there, and he didn't want to take on Rome. Because at this point, Rome is building and building, and they're much stronger than his kingdom of Syria. So he says, you know what I got to do? Verse 17, thus shall he do. He shall give the daughter of women. And he says, I got a plan. I don't want to fight with Egypt because the Romans will fight. I don't want to fight with them. What if I diplomatically propose outwardly a peace treaty with Egypt? And what I do is I take my young daughter, Cleopatra. Now, this is Cleopatra the First. We're talking about 195 B.C. You're all familiar with Cleopatra the Ninth, living 150 years later at the time of Mark Antony. But this is the first one. It's a common name. Cleo comes from the word glory, and Patra means father. Cleopatra, the glory of the father. And he had a daughter, Cleopatra the First. And he said, you know what? Why don't you marry this young king that's on the throne? He's not 6 years old anymore. He's closer to 18 or 19. But marry this young king. And once you get in there, honey, then I can use you to take the kingdom from the inside. So that's his plan in verse 17. He's going to give the daughter of women. Now, the reason she's called the daughter of women, Cleopatra the First was young. I don't know, she was 14 or 15 years old at the time he's marrying her off. And she can't take care of herself. So he sends her down with the mother and a nurse. And she's known as the daughter of women. That's what she was known as. So everybody knew her as the daughter of women. And she comes down, and he's corrupting her. His idea is, I'm going to use you to get in there. I'm scheming for you to privately work against your Egyptian husband and spy out for me, and I want to corrupt you. But the problem is his plan failed. At the end of the verse, it says, she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. As she got down there and she met the young king, I'm trying to remember his name, young King Ptolemy, I forget his last name. But anyways, young King Ptolemy, when she met this young boy, remember, when he took the kingdom, he didn't know what he was doing. So Agathocles was the one that did all the council meetings and the meetings with the generals and all the planning and the building and the engineers. And he, as a young boy, began to enjoy the perks of being a prince. And his other helper, Sosibius, didn't deter him, said, sure, you want to have some, yeah, have a good time. You want to get an Xbox and play video games? Go ahead, do what you want. And so he began to indulge himself. And when Cleopatra met him, Cleopatra had grown up with a father who was a strong leader, a general, always having meetings. Sorry, honey, I can't be with you today. I got a meeting to take care of. Sorry, I got business. Sorry, I got that. And all of a sudden, she meets a young guy who likes her and says, come on, let's go. I got a new video game. And she's playing, and she likes this guy rather than her father because he's indulging her. And so his plan didn't work. She neither stands on his side, end of verse 17, nor is she for him. So what is he going to do? Verse 18. After this, shall he turn his face unto the isles and take many? So Antiochus saw, my scheme's not working with my daughter. All right, fine. I can still do something. I've still got some power here. What's a good area that we can attack? Well, the Isles of Asia Minor are not in alliance with the Romans. They're kind of standing independently. Okay. So he built a vessel, a fleet of 300 vessels, and he armed them with munitions, and he sent them to the Isles of Asia Minor. After this shall he turn his face to the isles, and shall take many. And he brought many vessels with him, and many navy men, and many army men to go and fight. However, this is what happened. Verse 17, with the strength of his, 18, he went to face the isles, he'll take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him. He's reproaching the isles to take over, to cease. And what happened is there was a prince living over in the region of Asia Minor known as Prince Lucius Scipio Asiaticus. And he was of the region of Cornelia. His older brother was Prince Lucius Africanus, who was a great general who was working for the Roman army and was establishing what they call a patriarch. Rome at that time was still a republic, didn't have an emperor yet. So they were bringing in wealthy patriarchs to be senators, and his brother was a great warrior, and he was a young one, and he defended the isles and engaged Antiochus the minute his fleet disembarked at the Isle of Magnesia. Prince Scipio got his forces together, and when the army men came off, he looked, and they put a phalanx in front of him, and his brother had taught him, when you're outnumbered, and he was outnumbered, Antiochus had a good-sized army, Scipio didn't have one, he said, you know what the best thing to do is a bold surprise frontal attack. And he sent his people forward with archers and slingers who bombarded Antiochus's troop with projectiles. And Antiochus began at first a slow, organized retreat, but eventually his army dispersed in the face of this continuous projectile assault. And Antiochus, and it says there, middle of the verse, a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease, and without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. And he turned the battle against Antiochus, and Antiochus finally gathered his surviving troops and returned to Sardis, and he, Scipio, caused it, the reproach, to turn right back upon him, Antiochus, in the famous, what's known as, you can go online and look at it, the Battle of Magnesia in December 190 BC. And Antiochus had to go back. So what's he do? He's been kind of discouraged and disgraced, verse 19. And then he turns his face toward the fort of his own land. And Antiochus returns back to Antioch, which was his capital. And he decides at that time, why don't we send ambassadors to Rome? Because the first thing I want to do is, if I get in any more battles, now that Scipius is the younger brother of Africanus, and Africanus is becoming a senator in Rome, I don't want the Roman armies coming here because they'll wipe me out. So why don't I send a peace treaty to Rome? So he sends a bunch of ambassadors to Rome, verse 19. But here's what happens. The Romans hear about it, and Africanus says, you know, just fought with my younger brother. You just attacked the Isles. You tried to come down to Egypt where we got our grain from them. Yeah, we'll have a peace treaty on these conditions. And the conditions were this. Magnus, you have to relinquish all of your holdings in Europe and Asia Minor. Just keep in your own little corner of Syria. And we want tribute. You're going to be a tributary. We want 2,500 talents this year and 1,000 talents for the next 12 years. And that's why it says in the verse, and when he returns to his own land and he talks to the ambassadors, he's going to stumble. And so now this whole thing didn't work for me. So what am I going to do? So Antiochus Magnus begins to go all through his own empire, mostly the eastern provinces, to raise tribute money. And at one point, he gets to the province of Elam, over there where Persia used to be. And there's a temple of Bel in Elymas in Elam. And he needs money to pay the Romans. And he plunders the temple of Bel. What happens there is the Elamites were experts with archery. And they killed him. And they slew him. And that's why it says at the end of the verse, he shall stumble and fall and not be found. And that ended Antiochus Magnus in his reign. Verse 20. And then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. Antiochus Magnus' oldest son was Seleucus Philopater. And he now took the throne now that his father had been killed. The problem was he was only 9 years old. And the Romans still wanted the tax money. We want 1,000 talents a year. We don't care how old you are. Pay the money. So his men had to get together and go out and try to raise the money to pay the Romans. And what did? He raised taxes. And so he raised taxes on his own people. That's what his administrators told him to do. And for the first 10 years, he's raising taxes as much as he can to pay the Roman tribute. Verse 20, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Let me see how this happened. So he's trying to raise this money. He's 9 years old, 10 years old, 11, 12, 13. He's doing this for about 9 or 10 years. And on the 10th year, he was real hard pressed to raise the money. So he raised taxes in the glory of the kingdom, it says. He had to go and raise the money from his own subjects, and the glory of his kingdom, he wasn't sure where to get it. He sent some of his subjects, a guy by the name of Heliodorus. He said, look, go down, slip down the border, and go to Jerusalem and confiscate the silver and gold in the temple. And they did, to pay the Romans. So he'll raise taxes and in the glory of the kingdom, but in a few days he's destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Shortly after he raided God's temple, he mysteriously died at the age of 21 in 175 BC. Secular historians have no idea how he died. He didn't die in a battle. he just died suddenly at 21 years old. Just dropped dead after he raided the Lord's temple. And the historians say, well, he must have been poisoned, but there's no records of it anywhere. So it just shows that at that point God was getting ready, because God is going to do a work, because in the next century or so his son is coming. And that temple has to be in the right place for his son to enter in, because he promised Zechariah. He said he's going to enter into this temple. And that promise had been made. So God now is beginning to put his hand on it in preparation for the coming of his son. Okay, so he died neither in anger nor in battle. He just suddenly died. Verse 21, and now that he's gone, in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. Now, verses 21 through 31 are going to be a long section devoted to a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. I don't know if you've ever heard that name before. This is the one that's going to start the Maccabean Wars, Judas Maccabee. We're going to have the Feast of Hanukkah. All this is going to happen in this time period. And he was the most cruel king of the north. He was the greatest Syrian persecutor of the nation of Israel. He was the son of Antiochus Magus, and he's known as Antiochus Epiphanes. In his estate, that's now that Seleucus Philopater is dead, shall stand up a vile person, Antiochus, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, verse 21. Why? Because the
truth is, the kingdom wasn't supposed to be Antiochus. Demetrius Soter was the next in line for the throne. But the Romans were holding him hostage until they got the rest of their tribute money. They said, we'll let him sit on the throne when the rest of the tribute money's paid. Okay, so he's sitting there. In the meantime, Antiochus says, I've got to usurp the throne while this guy is being held hostage in Rome. And so Antiochus was 40 years old. He had learned a lot from his father, Antiochus Magnus. He had become experienced not only in war, but in politics. And so he said, I need the people to support me because I'm not worthy to sit on the throne. I mean, I'm not the next guy in line. And that was a very big thing back then. What can I do? I got an idea. Let me steal their hearts and buy them off. So he began using some of the tax money that should have gone to Rome immediately and held opulent banquets with the finest food and clothing and spices and started inviting the people in the city. He would scatter money to the Seleucid army, to all the soldiers. I got plenty of money for you guys. And the soldiers loved that thing. He was known to walk the streets of Antioch and just give money to people left and right. It wasn't his money to give. It was the Roman tax money. But the people loved it. I mean, he's buying their support. And so he stole the hearts of the people like Absalom did in 2 Samuel. And what it says in verse 21, they didn't want to give him the honor of the kingdom, so he came in peaceably, and he obtained the kingdom by flatteries. And he kind of bought the kingdom off. All right. Verse 22. As soon as he secured the throne, the first thing he did was he wanted to build a coalition to keep himself in power. So he built a coalition with a man named Attalus, and he built a coalition with the king of Pergamum named Eumenes. And verse 22, and with the arms of a flood, they shall be overflowing from before him. Together, what they did was they attacked the remaining Egyptian armies in a military onslaught that's known as a flood in the Bible. Go back to chapter 9. A flood is a military onslaught, like a wave of military people coming at you. When Daniel was given the prophecy in verse 26 of the ninth chapter, after 3 score and 2 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood unto the end of the war. See the floor, the war, the flood, the military, a battle that's going to go on. And we've read the book of Revelation. We know that there are going to be wars right up to the end, Jesus said, and then the battle of Armageddon. So back to where we are in the 11th chapter. This guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, gets a coalition with Attalus and the king of Pergamum. They get the arms of a flood. They attack the Egyptian armies in a military onslaught. And it says in the verse, where are we? 22. And they're broken. And the armies were defeated, the Egyptian armies. And then he says, yea, also the prince of the covenant. One of the things the rightful heir, remember, I told you, was Demetrius. He was being held hostage in Rome. And Demetrius learned of Antiochus Epiphanes and all the dealings that he was doing, and he wrote him a letter from Rome, and he said, I'm going to be released soon. And Antiochus said, oh, yeah, as soon as you get here, I'm going to abdicate the throne and let you sit on it. And he made a covenant with Demetrius that he would let him, you know, get the throne. But not only did he break the Egyptian army, were broken, he also broke the prince of the covenant. He broke his covenant with him, too. He never relinquished the throne once he got on it. Verse 23. And after the league made with him, that's the deal he made with Demetrius, he shall work deceitfully. Antiochus worked deceitfully, for he shall come up. Antiochus raised his stature by continuing to give gifts. His reputation grew, and he'll become strong with a small people. And the more he continued to give gifts to the common people, they thought, even if Demetrius comes back, we don't want him. We like this guy. He gives us welfare. He gives us cell phones. He gives us everything we want. This is the guy we want. And so they wanted him, and he enjoyed all the support and the favor of the common man in Antioch.
and he became strong with a small people. The next thing he did, verse 24, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province. This verse describes how I've been doing this in Antioch. I go out, you know, in the evenings and I give money to people in the streets. I have banquets here, but I need the support of the whole nation. I got to take this bribery show on the road. And so I got to go all throughout my province and do this. I need everyone to support me because the evening news isn't covering me anymore. But they didn't have evening news back then. So he had to go around, and he started taking this on the road. Where are we? The fattest places of the province. He went to the wealthiest cities in Syria. He went to Damascus and the other places, and he took this show of bribing people on the road. Let's see. He shall do that which his fathers have not done. No king did anything like that. Kings didn't lower themselves to common people back then. They were kings. They weren't politicians. They sat on a throne. You'd be lucky if you'd ever get in their presence or get an invitation to anything. And so he's doing something that's never been done before. What he was doing officially, according to some records I wrote, I think it's here in the book of the Syrians, he started the Democrat Party back in 165 B.C. Smart. And I'm just kidding. Anyway, so he's done that which his father's not done, and he shall, it says in verse 24, he shall scatter among them the prey and the spoil and the riches. Here's some money for you. Here's something for you. Wow, I love this guy. This is a great king. I want to keep him. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Now, one of the reasons he's going on the road and getting the support of the people is he's thinking, if these people love me, they'll fight for me. And he's getting young people, he's conscripting them into the army and into the navy, and he's building forces. Moms and dads are going, yeah, this is a great guy. You want to fight for this guy. This is a guy who cares for our land. It's Syria, über alles, you know, Deutschland, über alles. This is the guy we want to support. And so he's building up, making speeches. He shall forecast his devices against the strongholds. He's talking about, he would make speeches about, remember those awful Egyptians? You remember their hostility toward us? And because he wants to recruit Syrian soldiers to go back for the next war against Egypt. He did this, again, look at 24 again. He'll enter peaceably to the fattest places of the province. He's going town to town with this. He's doing stuff his parents have never done, no king's ever done. He's scattering among them prey and spoil and riches. He's making all these speeches about how great Syria is and we need to take over our enemy. And the first enemy he wants was Egypt. Even for a time. This is a interesting double reference. Number one, it took him 2 years to do it for a short time. Number two, as soon as he did it, he stopped giving things away. Now he owned the people and controlled them. It was like a fox in the hen house. At first, I'm like your friend. I'm here for you. Now he's going to rule totally by force and an iron fist over these people. He became one of the cruelest rulers ever, Antiochus Epiphanes. And he quit giving gifts and he ruled by force. Verse 25, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And what Antiochus did was he took his great army to go down to fight Ptolemy the Fifth Philometor in Egypt. Of course, the way there is through Israel, and they're marching through the Holy Land. And I don't know if you remember, but one of the reasons God's spending so much time on these battles between Syria and Egypt is because they're going back and forth through his land. And as I showed you last week, God isn't interested in secular history. He couldn't care less about secular history. He's not interested in lost people. He's interested in getting saved. But he's not interested in what they do. He's not interested in what they build. He's not interested in what they make. He's not interested in what they think. You want me to go over the verses with you again? You want to do it again? Were you here last week? Do you remember the verses? Okay. If it's not from God and of God and to God, he's got no interest. Remember I tried to teach you a few weeks ago, time doesn't flow from the past to the future.
time flows from the future to the past. God sits in eternity, and he lets time flow out, and he gives you a new day. And then you live that day, and that becomes the past. And then he gives you another new day, and that becomes the past. And here's what God says. If you live within my giving, all things are of God and to God and through God. If you live with this, anything you do there, I'm going to remember. Anytime you step outside my gift and do what you want, I'm going to wipe that all out. It's all vanity. The name of the wicked shall perish. It's all going to be forgotten. So the point that he's mentioning these two nations is they're trampling on his land. Now, I just want to give you a spiritual thought that crossed my mind. God delivered his people out of Egypt, and he said it was the iron furnace. And the picture of their physical salvation is a picture of spiritual salvation. We were in the iron furnace of our flesh and our lusts, and God delivered us into, let's say, the promised land of salvation. Israel represents a soul that's been delivered out of the flesh. We're no longer married to our flesh. We're now married to God. So out of the flesh into the soul, and it's a saved soul. Jesus Christ is the shepherd and the bishop of our souls. I came to call the lost to repentance and sinners to salvation. And though your sins be as scarlet, they'll be white as snow, and the soul is saved. The soul that sinneth, it shall die, but the soul can be saved. And so that's that. I've got Egypt representing the flesh. I've got the soul that's saved in Israel. Syria represents the spirit. And all these battles are a picture of what goes on in your life. Your saved soul is constantly at war, not between God's Holy Spirit and flesh, but your own spirit sometime. Your own spirit gets up and causes a fight, and your spirit and your flesh are warring one with another over your saved soul. And so what's a historical picture here is a spiritual picture of the battles we face. And so God's writing this down here, just letting us see it. But these are actual historical truths that God told Daniel. This is all going to happen before the first coming. And he laid it out so well that most secular historians can't accept that Daniel was alive in 500-something and wrote all this, because these are dates of 200, 170, 160, 150. How did he know these things? Because God gave him prophecy. So, verse 25, he, that's Antiochus Epiphanes, will stir up his power against the king of the south, and he leads his army now down through Israel to attack Ptolemy in Egypt. But word reached the Egyptian king of the coming attack. So it says, stirred up his courage against king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. And so the king of Egypt prepared a great and mighty army, not just of Egyptians, but men from Ethiopia, Libya. But one of the problems is he shall not stand. The Egyptian couldn't win for two reasons. Number one, his principal ally, Rome, who normally would have stood with him and fought like they did a while back, was embroiled in the Third Macedonian War, and they couldn't help him. They said, we're tied up right now in a war. I mean, we'd be happy to come help you, but you're on your own. And the king of the south had to kind of fight on his own, and he could not stand. That's the first reason. He shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. The second reason was Ptolemy's was betrayed by his own counselors. He had men that were supposed to be around him. Remember David got betrayed by Ahithophel, his counselor? This happens a lot. There are men that creep into positions of high places, and they betray their leaders. And verse 26, yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him. Many of his war cabinet, they were taking bribes from Antiochus, and they were giving Ptolemy and his generals the wrong advice. They forecast devices, end of verse 25, against him. They would say, you know, you need to fight in this area. But they knew exactly that's where Antiochus' army was for a surprise attack to take them out. And what happened was the Egyptian army was led into ambushes and overrun by the Syrian forces. End of 26. His army shall overflow, and many shall fall down and be slain. And Antiochus's army overflowed the many Egyptian soldiers who fell down and were slain. And that's all I got. I'm sorry. Now, there's much, much more to study in Antiochus Epiphanes, because when he comes back from Egypt, he's going to do some terrible damage inside the Holy Land, and God is going to stir up men to fight for his temple, and he's going to do a great miracle for them. And so we'll look at that. We only got as far as, what was it, verse 25, 26 today. I'm sorry. We'll try and, if you want, we'll continue. It's going to take maybe two more weeks. Is that okay? Because these are a lot of boring details. But if anybody wants copies, I got it all written up. But who wants to know this stuff? Okay, this is at 3 pages of typewritten notes.